ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you do consider moving to rural, remote, and regional Australia, be aware of those things. I would say advocate on behalf of rural Australia to get extra services.
Regional Australia's population surged during COVID with people seeking a change of lifestyle. But access to services is often not like in the city, especially health services. Now, new residents in the bush are being urged to advocate for better health resources for their new communities. That story soon. And financial support was announced this week for student teachers, nurses, midwives and social workers who are undertaking an unpaid placement. Now, a rural vet says student vets need similar support.
We're looking to get young professionals back into regional Australia, and the only way to really do that is to make sure that they see why they should be there, and placements are part of that.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. It was a great tree change and sea change. Regional Australia's population surged during and after COVID as people turned away from the hustle and bustle of city life for a quieter, more calm existence in the country. You probably know someone who moved to a regional or rural area, or maybe you were the one who moved. But one of the tough things about moving from the city to many regional areas is access to services, especially health services. Rockhampton reporter Scout Wallen has been looking into this. She's spoken to a family requiring specialist treatment, healthcare workers and advocates who have some advice for those wanting to make the lifestyle change.
It really affects Annabelle's ability to be a normal teenager. She doesn't go out. She won't leave the house because she's scared that she will have a seizure in the community and mum won't be there.
When Rebecca Newstab and her family moved from the hustle and bustle of the Gold Coast to the sleepier central Queensland town of Yeppoon 3 years ago, they were chasing a lifestyle change. But what they didn't expect was the rapid deterioration of their 15-year-old daughter's medical condition.
She was officially diagnosed at four of having epilepsy.
Living on the northern end of the Gold Coast, Annabelle was getting treatment at a major children's hospital in Brisbane, and that was about a 50-minute car drive from their home. But 6 months into their move to Yeppoon, Annabelle went from having seizures once every few months to 1 to 2 times a week. It took them 6 months to get in to see a paediatrician and 2.5 years to get an appointment with a neurologist, and they had to travel down to Brisbane.
Like, we've considered moving back to Brisbane so that we can get treatment for Annabelle. I believe that if we were still in Brisbane that we would not have waited 2.5 years to see a neurologist.
Now, regional parts of Queensland have been booming since the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the Centre for Population, regional Queensland was the fastest growing regional area in Australia in 2021 to 2022. And we all know why. It's a great place to live.
You know, if you're looking at the happiness scale in Australia, the people that live in rural, remote and regional Australia actually say they're happier and those people living in the city.
That's Susan Teagan. She heads up the National Rural Health Alliance. And with more people comes more pressure on our regional and rural health systems.
30% of the population live in rural, remote and regional Australia. So it's a large population. We often have up to 16 years less life. So that means that people are dying 14 to 16 years earlier in rural and remote in particular than they are in urban centres.
She says it all comes down to workforce shortages and the underfunding of rural and regional health services.
We're expecting things from those health workers that we would never expect from health workers in the city. And because they're out of sight, rural Australia is being forgotten.
So what can you do if you have moved recently or are considering moving to the regions and want to make sure your health won't suffer? Well, Rebecca says, do your research.
Bring the hospital, not just look online at what they say they have, services that they do have. They clearly don't, because they said that, you know, that there was a visiting neurologist and, you know, the paediatricians and all of that. Well, they're very hard to get into to start with, and there's no neurologist that comes and visits anymore.
Dr. Alyssa Hatley is a GP who works in the Mackay region, and she has a great tip for trying to get in to see a GP.
You might need a recommendation from a friend or a neighbour to say, hey, I've got these really nice neighbours coming. They've just moved to the area. could you please take them on? Having someone to vouch for you really does help.
Dr. Hathley also says that telehealth can be a great tool for newcomers, and they can set that up once they get in to see a GP.
So certainly in general practice, we use it a lot for visits with psychiatrists, for visits with dermatologists, some of those other professions where we might just be able to look at what the condition is and we don't have to lay hands on patients necessarily, or we don't have to lay hands on patients as often.
But Susie says at the end of the day, no matter if you've lived here for your whole life or just a few months, the best way to ensure your healthiest future is to do what Rebecca and Annabelle are doing, speak up and advocate for your regional health services.
If you do consider moving to rural, remote and regional Australia, be aware of those things. I would say advocate on behalf of rural Australia to get extra services.
It's a very hard decision to make of whether to move to an area where services are very limited.
That's Central Queensland mother, Rebecca Newstub, finishing off that report by Scout Wallen.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Earlier this week, the federal government announced financial support for students who need to complete significant prac placement hours in order to graduate. Eligible courses include those studying social work, nursing and teaching, but not veterinary students. Regan Lynch, a mixed animal vet from northwest Queensland, studied veterinary science for 5 years before graduating in 2015. She told our reporter Madeline McCosker that the lack of financial support during prac placement is a barrier for students wanting to get into the industry.
It was really hard at times where you do the practical throughout your entire course. So on top of being at university, trying to have a job to earn money to live, you're also then asked to go away in week blocks at a time, not earn an income. You're often travelling to a different place outside where you might have resources to complete your placements. And for a lot of students, you can often be travelling hundreds of kilometres on your own bat to go somewhere to do a couple of weeks of placement, and then having to move on and do that again and again throughout your degree.
Do you think it's a barrier for people that want to get into the industry?
Yeah, for some people it is a barrier, because financially we're asking our young students to really nearly run themselves into a bit of debt in order to graduate, let alone get a job.
Just this week, the federal government announced the Commonwealth prac payment. What do you think about vets not being included in that?
I do think it's very disappointing. We have 3,000 veterinary students in Australia that are required to do these unpaid placements, and doing 52 weeks, as you said, a year of placement over their degree, means that our students have to make decisions around not only where they go, but do they need to put their degree on pause so they can work to try and support getting through their degree. And that drawing out that process just makes it a lot harder for students to get out there and to complete degrees.
The veterinary industry is already in a really difficult position at the moment. Many have said that it's in a crisis point. How do you think something like this is going to impact the industry moving forward?
Students who go into the veterinary course, they do it because they have a love of animals. They want to help people. But if it's seen to be a financial burden, and for a lot of these students it can be, then the decision between potentially completing a course and not being in significant, being in less debt versus doing a veterinary degree and getting more debt can potentially put barriers on people even applying for these courses. And I think it'd be a real shame that we would lose some really great future veterinarians because financially they have to make a decision about what courses is going to leave them better off because of placement. And unfortunately that's a real concern going forward with cost of living. I think people are having to be much more aware about what their next 5 years is going to look like and how are they going to cope with it. We're looking to get young professionals back into regional Australia, and the only way to really do that is to make sure that they see why they should be there. Mm-hmm. And placements are part of that. It would be the same in nursing and medical degrees. You know, we have these fantastic regional towns and we don't get the chance sometimes to show off why you'd want to live there, which is a shame.
That was Regan Lynch, a mixed animal vet from northwest Queensland. Dr. Diana Barker, president of the Australian Veterinary Association, said it's a very disappointing outcome, both for vet students and regional communities.
This is a huge blow to veterinary students around Australia, and the fact that veterinary profession has not been recognised as an essential service to our communities, especially when we're in the midst of a shortage and a crisis, particularly in rural and regional Australia for veterinarians. I can't understand how this decision has been made. Veterinary degree is one of the most expensive degrees to undertake in Australia. On average, a veterinarian earns about a third of a GP salary, so it's not a very well-paid profession. Our profession simply can't afford to support our students on placement, which is why we are calling out the government to step in and help with funding for these placements, given that veterinarians are an absolute essential part of our community, and even more so in our rural and regional areas where we have a crisis and a shortage of veterinarians.
And so the Commonwealth PRAC payment that's been announced is essentially a payment of $319.50 a week for eligible students, which, as I mentioned earlier, were teachers, nurses, midwives, among others. So what kind of difference do you think that would make to anyone studying veterinary science?
Many students try to find placements that are close to their workplace and their home. So they don't have to pay for accommodation. They don't have to take time off work because that's additional costs to them when they're on placement. What this means is that the students aren't going to those rural and regional areas to do their placement. And we know that if students have that exposure during their practical placement, they are more likely to go to rural and regional areas for their jobs when they graduate. So this is a self-perpetuating issue. Veterinarians play these key roles in biosecurity, in livestock, in agriculture in Australia. So it's not just the pets and the individual benefits, but it's also this sort of public good and, you know, protection of, you know, a huge part of the nation's economy.
That's the president of the Australian Veterinary Association, Dr. Diana Barker, speaking there with our reporter, Madeline McCosker. 140,000 Victorian families are using free kinder this year with the rollout of funded 3- and 4-year-old programs. That rollout and the construction of 50 new kindergartens was meant to be finished over the next 5 years. But yesterday's state budget revealed delays in the expansion of Victoria's free kinder and the construction of the new centres. Some centres say the influx in state government funding support is helping low-income families, but other centres say the free kinder scheme may force them to close. From Regional Victoria, reporter Shannon Schubert has this story.
For this family of four, their local kindergarten in central Victoria has been a lifesaver.
I actually feel lost not coming here anymore. She had fluid build up in her ears, which caused the speech delay and the hearing loss, and then she smacked her teeth out. She was severely asthmatic.
That's Mother Alicia McAway talking about her daughter and Elise. Her two daughters have autism, and she says when they first started at Shine Bright Kangaroo Flat, they had behavioural issues and barely spoke. But by the time they left, the girls were ready for school, according to their father, Tyson Murphy.
What they've done for our family, and not just our family, like every other family as well, they just guide you the right way. Just watching the girls, just how they develop in the years, how hard like they put in to get them all school ready. Nearly brings a tear to your eye.
The Bendigo Centre has a high number of families from low socioeconomic backgrounds. Educators say extra state government funding has helped them respond to families' needs, such as providing food relief, health referrals, as well as providing early childhood education.
So we're ensuring that every child is heard and every family is heard for what they need for their child.
That's kindergarten educator Becky Parkinson. The centre supports the Victorian government's free kinder initiative, which will eventually be expanded from 15 hours to 30 hours. 30 hours was supposed to be fully funded by 2032, but according to yesterday's budget papers, that will now be rolled out over the next 10 years. Premier Jacinta Allen blames workforce shortages for the delay.
We have a series of shortages, worker shortages, that is putting pressure on the delivery of these programs. We have had to make a more gradual rollout of four-year-old kinder.
Early Learning Association Australia has also dubbed the Victorian government's free kinder a success. CEO Andrew Cameron.
We know that parents are able to return to work in greater numbers and finding young children able to have more positive transitions to school. And we're hearing anecdotally on the ground those stories every day.
But not all kindergartens are happy with the approach. Some sessional kindergartens, including community-based and council-run centres, say they're worse off. In Melbourne's East, Bellevue Kindergarten Coordinator Carla Sutton says the $2,500 per child subsidy barely covers the cost of running their programs. It used to charge parents double that amount, but under free kinder, it can't.
We've had to ask parents to donate toilet paper and tissues, and we've also had to cut back our cleaner from 5 days down to 3 days.
Ms Sutton wants the Victorian government to adjust the scheme to make the free kinder payment a contribution to fees, allowing sessional centres to charge parents a gap fee.
If we're unable to charge parents a gap fee, then community-based kindergartens will eventually have to close.
Yesterday's Victorian budget showed that kinder enrolments have increased by 10,000 children since the rollout began. In New South Wales, the state government pays for 15 hours a week for 2 years of preschool education. Queensland does too, but concerns have been raised that their scheme leaves lower-income families with more out-of-pocket expenses. Ahead of the Productivity Commission's report next month, early education specialists want a simple national free kindergarten program with 30 hours of funded education in the 2 years before school.
Bendigo reporter Shannon Schubert with that story. A mandatory code of conduct between supermarkets and suppliers with significant penalties for breaches is one of the key recommendations from a recent Senate inquiry. The Greens-led inquiry, which examined the pricing practices and market power of the major supermarkets, delivered its report yesterday. Riverina reporter Emily Doak has been following the story.
The Senate supermarket pricing inquiries made 14 recommendations, but only one of them is supported by the whole committee, to make the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct mandatory with tougher penalties. Committee Chair Green Senator Nick McKim says it follows emotional evidence from a number of growers about the supply arrangements with the major supermarkets.
Particularly from farmers who've recently left their farming business because they felt that they could speak up. And we heard repeatedly evidence that farmers are too frightened, quite reasonably, to speak out because they're worried about retribution from Coles and Woolworths in terms of just not buying from them or reducing their volumes or reducing the prices that they're prepared to offer. So one of the things we've done is recommend that the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, which governs in large part the relationship between supermarkets and the people they purchase from, that be made mandatory with significant penalties, and also that there be provisions in that code of conduct to allow for anonymous complaints to be made by farmers so they are not facing that kind of retribution I spoke about.
Other recommendations include making price gouging illegal, stronger powers for the ACCC, and laws to allow the federal court to break up monopolies if they abuse market power.
Competition is what drives prices down and leads to better outcomes for consumers, but also that competition provides for better outcomes for people who supply the supermarkets as well. So on both of those metrics, we are failing. We need more competition, and that's why I was really pleased that the committee recommended the introduction of divestiture powers.
The report's been welcomed by the farm sector. NFF Horticulture Council member Jeremy Griffith is pleased about the recommendation to include nursery suppliers in the Food and Grocery Code.
All the issues that the plant life nursery growers face are exactly the same as a fresh fruit and vegetable grower. So we think that's been a very key and a very important inclusion to these recommendations. We're fully supportive of that. Because the product is perishable, they are highly vulnerable. They are the most vulnerable sector to the supermarkets, to the retailers in this country. The supermarkets know that the product is perishable. As the ACCC describes it, they can offer take it or leave it prices, typically at rock bottom prices, knowing full well that the growers have almost no choice but to accept the price that has been offered.
He also supports giving the competition watchdog more teeth.
So we've been very fully supportive of giving the agency the powers to go in and look at the practices and the behaviours of the supermarket, and then to give them actually meaningful powers and penalties and fines to drive behavioural change.
Riverina citrus grower Vito Mancini dumped hundreds of tonnes of blemished oranges in 2022. He's welcomed the inquiry's call to look at the national food waste strategy to see if unrealistic cosmetic standards imposed by supermarkets are adding to the problem.
Every retailer out there is selling fruit and veg, and they want to have better quality at lower price than everybody else. So they continually to refine their standards, keep pushing the envelope and keep pushing it back onto the grower to try and meet a standard that sometimes is virtually impossible. So from where we were 20 years ago to where we are today, we are most certainly throwing out more fruit that would have been on people's fruit bowls. And unless we have some sort of intervention, that trend will continue.
With three dissenting reports, securing government support for the recommendations will be challenging. Vice President of the New South Wales Farmers Association, Rebecca Reardon, is calling on the federal government to enact them all.
Look, we generally support the entire set of recommendations. It's putting a whole lot of tools in the toolbox to try and address what has been price gouging, unfair practices and a lack of transparency. And so I do thank the senators for actually listening to the farmers and listening to the people and the consumers. And the rest of the government needs to follow suit.
Meanwhile, research by Roy Morgan shows consumers are also taking note. On the list of trusted brands, Coles has fallen more than 220 spots from being the fifth most trusted brand to become the ninth most distrusted, and Woolworths from the second most trusted brand to the 34th.
Emily Doak with that report. And we end today's show in Newcastle, where the local magic has been kept alive by one truly unique character for more than 40 years. At 78 years old, Super Hubert is still entertaining audiences with his weird and wonderful magic meets comedy performances. Larice Dixon has this story.
Australia's skinniest magician. Yeah, I just came up with that. I'm yet to have anyone. I don't care if they're someone skinnier than me. Good luck to them if they're, what, 53 kilo? 6 foot 1.
Super Hubert greets me at his door, dressed in his trademark red and blue star-spangled lycra suit with a magic wand tucked into his belt. On the inside of his house is a shrine to a career that spans over 40 years. There are posters and memorabilia. There's even an artwork from when he was painted for the Archibald Prize. From an early age, Hugh Nossiter was fascinated by magic.
Stephen, my older brother, brought home a little trick from Woolworths, and I was the one that took to it, and I've still got it. Tiny little plastic, cheapest dollar trick, and I was the one that took to it.
It became his obsession.
Well, the minute I started work, I had money. There were three magic shops in Sydney. I'd catch the Northwood bus and walk to all the magic shops, and I still use a couple of them today. And then I did my first show at Lane Cove 12-foot Skiff Sailing Club. It must have been really terrible. But then in those days, kids didn't know. They didn't have much. A magician came round. They had no idea how to talk or anything.
Hugh developed his own unique persona to sell the tricks. On stage, he became this kind of absurd slapstick figure, running around and yelling loudly and calling himself Hubert Super Magician.
I just did what I did in the clubs. I made everyone laugh, and that was the thing. My magic, I know, wasn't clever, but it's how I use it.
Hugh had moved from Sydney to work in and eventually buy a furniture factory in Terralba. That meant he could make whatever he would come up with.
And I thought, I know, I'll do that. And I changed to a Superman figure.
Is it a mime? Is it a comic? No, it's our next act. Hubert, Super Magician. Make him welcome, Super Magician. Oh, yeah, oh!
This was the 80s, when a magician could fill a room as midweek entertainment. Hubert could play adult shows or kids' gigs. His life suddenly became booked and busy. Round Newcastle, Super Hubert was everywhere. He was on Saturday breakfast television, local radio, popping up at nights games, handing out lollies. Times change. There's not a club circuit for entertainers like Super Hubert anymore. Still performs gigs in local RSLs, but it's just a smaller audience than it was in the heyday of the 80s and 90s.
What's kept you going for that long? Like, have you ever been tired of it?
No. can't. This is what I do now, and I think I'll probably just drop or something. I don't know what will happen, but it'd be very hard to just give up. We can't give up and retire, because, like the show, you get better at it.
That's Super Hubert, the magician, ending that story by Newcastle reporter Louise Dixon. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.